Great. Thanks, Ignacio. Thanks for having me here. So the subject of this talk is Liebschultz-Mannes constraints. I'm going to put in quotation marks here because the point is to get a much more general constraint that has been discussed before. We're going to use more of the symmetries of the lattice. So this is work which should be posted next week. Taking the lead is Adrian Po, who's in the audience here, along with Chao Ming, who's at KITP, and Haruki Watanabe. And it's following up on earlier work with those authors and Ashvin, as well as collaborators at Station Q. So I think in at least all the experimental talks we've heard from here, in which there's indications of topological order, have something in common, and that is some notion of fractional filling. So when Andrea told us about the quantum Hall effect, the fraction at play is this fractional filling of the electrons. So that's the density of electrons p relative to the flux quanta q. And when these occur at fractions, we get these exotic fractional quantum Hall states where the excitations carry fractional charge. And there's, in fact, a relation between the filling fraction, the density of electrons, and the charge of the emergent excitations. So another example occurs, for instance, in the Herbert Smithite material we just heard about, or the spin liquid materials. There, instead of it being the density of electrons, it's the fact that within the unit cell, there's spin 1/2 moments. And in this case, for instance, we can have fractional excitations, which are the spin-ons, which carry spin 1/2. Now, the fact that the materials we've seen come from these systems, which have some notion of fractional filling, I think isn't a coincidence. It's really an example of this general type of constraint, which I'll call a Liebschultz-Mannes constraint. And so I mean it in the most general sense. I'll call a Liebschultz-Mannes constraint to be some constraint between the way the symmetry is implemented in the UV at the lattice scale, so for instance, that the magnet was made of spin 1/2 rather than spin 1, and what possible orders can emerge in the infrared. And I find this somewhat non-trivial. Usually we think that in some RG flow, as emergence occurs, we forget what's happening at the lattice scale. But these are constraints where something about the lattice is remembered, and that's the symmetry content. So the most concrete example, or at least the first example of it, was due to Lieb, Schultz, and Mattis in 1963, and then generalized to two and higher dimensions by Oshikawa and Hastings and others. And at least the way it's generally interpreted is as follows. So suppose you have a Hamiltonian of spins with a translation symmetry. Because you have translation, you can define a unit cell, and you can ask within the unit cell, is the total amount of spin half integer or integer? If it is half integer, it's shown that one of three phases can emerge. One, you could just break the symmetry. It could become a nail magnet or some sort of valence bond phase. Two, you could have a gapless liquid. So for instance, this could be this Dirac proposal that Yin Chen discussed. Or the third possibility is it can be gapped, but in that case, it has to have these emergent anionic excitations, which are topologically ordered. And both of these we'd refer to as a spin liquid. So what's missing from this list are phases which are both symmetric and short-range entangled. So a short-range entangled phase could be, for instance, a product state, or all the topological insulators and SPT phases that, for instance, Mike talked about. So I'll mean in general that a Liebschultz-Mannes is a constraint that says when is it impossible to have a symmetric short-range entangled phase. Now, the reason a constraint like this is useful is because experimentally, it's generally fairly straightforward to figure out when a symmetry is broken or not. So if we can show in one of these materials that the symmetry is preserved, then we know that there's something interesting or exotic happening, such as a gapless spin liquid or a topologically ordered system. So since those results, there's been a number of extensions. It becomes a little bit difficult to say what exactly all the theorems are. But I think it's helpful to think of it as being organized into sort of three sets of contributions. So the first I just talked about only made reference to the translation symmetry. So the thing that got counted in this constraint was the spin per unit cell. Then a couple of years ago, I learned about this from Sid Parameswaran, who noticed that you can do better if you take into account other lattice symmetries. So the symmetries here are the so-called non-somorphic symmetries, but what you should have in mind, for instance, is a glide symmetry, which is a translation combined with a reflection, or a screw symmetry in three dimensions. And sort of the gist of it is we can now count a spin per reduced unit cell. So let me explain what I mean by that. So an example of a sort of texture or lattice which has a glide symmetry is someone walking down the beach. The translation symmetry will take the right foot to the right foot, but there's another symmetry where we go half a step and then exchange the left with the right. So that's the glide symmetry. Now the unit cell here is highlighted in pink, and that contains 2 feet. So for instance, if you imagine this is actual a magnet where these are spin 1/2 moments, the unit cell contains integer spin because it has 2 of them. But you can see from the glide that there's a certain sense in which I can define a smaller unit cell, which is just half this region. And under the glide, this smaller region tiles the entire pattern. So I'll think of this reduced thing, which tiles the entire region, as a reduced unit cell. And then I can instead count how many spins there are in the reduced unit cell. And now it's just 1. So what was shown here is even if the magnet contains integer spin in the unit cell, if there's half integer spin in a reduced unit cell, there's still a constraint which says that it can't be a short-range entangled phase. So what I want to talk about in this talk is the extension to a completely general set of symmetries. So in these two results, point group symmetries, like a rotation, were never used. So I want to talk about what's the most general constraint we can have if we use the full space group. So the starting point is a magnet, which is symmetric under 2 things. First, there's the space group, which I'll call S. So that's just a permutation of the sites, like the glide, for instance. And then we have the internal symmetry, which is the spin rotation of the magnet. So at least for the purpose of this talk, you'll see I take a direct product structure here. So that means I'm ignoring something like spin orbit coupling. And at the moment, I don't actually understand the full structure when there's spin orbit coupling, which will be an interesting future question. OK, so we'd like to know whether some complicated material, like Herbert Smithite, has a no-go of this form. But for the purposes of the constraints, we're going to forget a lot of information. All we really care about is when we have these moments, is the moment integer, which I'll draw as a white site, or half integer, which I draw as a dark site. So in particular, as far as the constraint is concerned, 3/2 is the same as 1/2. So I just get this kind of z2 valued lattice. Then the question is, if you have a model defined on this lattice, can it be short-range entangled? So here's the conjecture, and it's a little bit frightening to phrase a conjecture, which I can't prove in all cases. But the conjecture is that if you have a model defined on a lattice, it can be in a short-range entangled phase only if that lattice is equivalent to a trivial lattice. OK, so far we can't interpret this because I need to define what I mean by a trivial lattice and what I mean by equivalence. That's what I'll do next. OK, so a trivial lattice I'm going to define to be a lattice which only contains integer spins. So for instance, you could have a Heisenberg magnet on a square lattice where all the spins are spin 1. This is already kind of interesting. So the conjecture is claiming that a magnet like this can be short-range entangled while preserving all the symmetries, like the C4 rotation, the mirror symmetries. This isn't entirely obvious. So some of you might be familiar that if this was spin 2 here, it's very easy to get a short-range entangled phase, and that's the generalization of the AKLT state. But there's this constraint that shows up when you make the AKLT wave function, which is that the spin on each site needs to be the coordination number of the lattice, which here is 4 divided by 2 is 2. So you can't use the AKLT state to get a short-range entangled phase here. And there's actually a kind of field theoretic interpretation of this constraint in Haldane's analysis of the nonlinear sigma model representation of the phase. And what he found is if you look at these monopoles, which are the things you'd like to proliferate in order to get a paramagnet, these monopoles actually see a background of flux, of staggered flux, and that staggered flux goes as I to the 2s. So in particular, if s is 1, they actually see this background fluxed. And the interpretation due to Reed and Sachdev was if you were to proliferate them to try and get a paramagnet, you'd actually break lattice symmetries. Now, once s is 2, you can get a trivial phase again. So this is somewhat worrying. It may be that actually spin 1 is different than spin 2, even though I told you I was only keep track of integer versus half integer. But with Chow Ming, it turns out that you can actually generalize the AKLT construction. You can think of it as a more general type of valence bond state using tensor networks. And you can actually propose an ansatz state for a spin 1 magnet, which is manifestly short-range entanglement symmetric. So it's not enough for it just to seem hard to write down a symmetric short-range entangled state, because with this more sophisticated language, you can sometimes find states behind what the field theory would suggest. OK, so that's what a trivial lattice is. It's made of integers. Now I need to define the equivalence relation. So there's going to be two allowed moves in order for lattices to be equivalent. So the first is sort of obvious. You're allowed to move the spins around in space as long as throughout the process you preserve all the lattice symmetries. So for instance, in this lattice, I want to keep mirror, C3 rotations, and translations, which means that I move one spin, say this one, everything else throughout space has to sort of go in a coordinated way to make sure the symmetry is preserved. So that's the first move. Now the second move, I need to decide what happens if two spins come together and collide. So the idea is the only thing I'm going to keep track of is whether it's integer or half integer. So when they collide together, they just fuse according to this Z2 fusion. Now, of course, the actual fusion of spins is more complicated, like a 1 and 1 could give a 0, 1, and 2. But I ignore that. I just keep track of the Z2. So the typical thing that's going to happen in these moves is that points are going to come in, and they'll generally come in multiplets because of the symmetries. Like if there's a reflection plane here, I'm always going to have 2 coming in. And then they can come in and annihilate. Whereas if it was a C3 point symmetry, 3 would come in, but 3 of them won't annihilate. We'll leave one behind. So these two rules give me an equivalence relation on lattices. So it's kind of fun to compute them. There's been a slight change of notation here. Suppose I had a honeycomb lattice of spin 1 halves, which here are honeybees. And I'd like to know, is the spin 1 half honeycomb a trivial lattice according to this equivalence relation? So the first thing I'm going to do, I'm going to start with the spins, which are on the sites of the honeycomb. And according to the rule, I can turn 1 into 3, because that preserves the parity. So now each site is split up into 3. And now the bees can crawl along the bond of the honeycomb here. And when they meet, they fuse into a trivial, integer spin, which is here a flower. So we see through this deformation, I've turned the honeycomb of spin 1 halves into a Kagome lattice of spin 1s. But by definition, this is all integer, so it's a trivial lattice. So I'd say the spin 1 half honeycomb lattice is trivial. So the prediction from the conjecture would be that even though it's not obvious, there should be some way to write down a state on the honeycomb lattice which is short-range entangled. This had puzzled me for a really long time. Chaoming and I had tried, and the only states we could find were gapless, but Ying Ran's group, along with Braden, who's here, were actually able to finally come up with another type of tensor network state, which is just a trivial paramagnet on the spin 1 half honeycomb. So kind of interesting consequence of that, if you think about graphene, normally when we talk about graphene at charge neutrality, we talk about all the ordered states that could occur, like a Cooley pattern. But this suggests that if you had really strong interactions, in principle, there's an insulating phase of graphene with a gap to everything, which is completely symmetric. And you do that in two steps. First, you'd assume there's a strong Hubbard U so that the fermions localize to sites. Then you have moments. And then those moments would enter this kind of exotic phase. It's not too exotic. It's a short-range entangled phase that they wrote down. OK, so once I have this equivalence relation, it's natural to then classify lattices. So sort of the input would be a space group, and then you can calculate all the equivalence classes. Now, these equivalence classes are actually naturally an abelian group. And the group operations is you can just take two lattices and stack them on top of each other. And the identity element is, of course, the lattice with no spins at all. What was that? Because I have this Z2 rule, you can see in that case, if you just take a lattice and put it on top of its, you know, an identical copy, because the rule is that -1 squared is 1, it just, yeah, because it's order 2, yeah. I'll generalize this slightly if it was some other rule than Z2, but for spins, Z2 is the relevant. So I asked Mike what you might call this, this lattice classification problem, and he told me it was the way not to define equivariant homology. That it's like the naive version of it. So let's actually, in 1D, we can kind of do this completely. So let's suppose our space group in 1D is translation and then a reflection. So it's kind of simple to see that we're going to get four inequivalent lattice types. There's the empty one. And then the sort of representatives is there's some special points. This is very similar to Mike's talk, which are the reflection planes. So within the unit cell, which is from here to here, there's two points which are reflection planes. And the representative lattices are whether or not you put a spin on each reflection plane. So that's going to give a 2x2 classification. OK, so why is this one non-trivial? Like, why can't you go from this one to this one? Well, it's just because that, you know, when you're moving the spins around, if they come in towards a reflection plane, they always come in as a pair. But because they, you know, have this Z2 rule, that can't change the parity on a reflection plane, so you naturally get two invariants. Yeah, so the black spins are half integer, and the white are integer. So I mean, the first thing you can do is, in principle, there could be, you know, lattice sites, many other points. It doesn't have to be reflection planes, but you can first bring everything into the reflection planes using the deformation. So that's why these are representatives. Yeah. Yeah, what I want to indicate here is the translation symmetry only relates that site to that site. That's the translation unit cell, so these can be inequivalent. So the conjecture would say that a magnet like this can be short-range entangled, so for instance, the Haldane phase, whereas these three would all have to be gapless. Now, these two we already knew from Liebschultz-Mattis, because within the unit cell there's an odd number of spin 1/2s. This one is beyond Liebschultz-Mattis, because this, you know, within the unit cell, this still has integer spin, because there's two black here. But because you have this half-integer moment on a reflection plane, the claim is it still has to be a gapless spin chain. OK, just for the sake of completeness, because of this audience, you could ask, well, how would I generalize this if the symmetry carried by my sites wasn't SO3, but was instead some other internal symmetry group, G? So then the role of integer versus half-integer is instead whether the site carries a projective representation of the symmetry or not. So we know projective representations are classified by the second group cohomology. So now you can imagine the site is labeled by an element of the cohomology class. So you could have the same moving them around move, but then when they come together, the fusion, rather than being Z2, would just be the way that projective representations fuse. So H2 is an abelian group, and you just use the group multiplication. OK, so it's kind of nice. You can then, so for instance, let's consider 2D. In 2D, there's 17 space groups, the wallpaper groups. And this table, just for some amount of generality, we consider projective representations, which are Zn. So for spin, this would just be Z2. You can compute all the inequivalent lattices, and you get these various factors here. And one way to interpret it is that there's this first factor was just calculating the sort of spin in the reduced unit cell. So all the existing constraints just relied on this index. And in this talk, this is saying all these cases, you wouldn't get a no-go before, but you do get a no-go now if the lattice is non-trivial, has a non-trivial index here. Well, OK, so I'm not specifying what G is. G is whatever your internal symmetry, you know, that previously it was SO3, but you could ask maybe it's some other, maybe U3 or, you know, SO4, whatever your. Yeah, so I'm just assuming that the G is such that the set of projective representations is Zn. It turns out once you have this table for an arbitrary like type of projective representation, you can easily extend it based on this. And the sort of thing that usually shows up, GCD is greatest common denominator. So it's sort of intuitive. What you need to know is whether the order of the point groups, like whether you have a C2 versus C3 symmetry, is commensurate with the order of the projective representation, order being this n here. OK, so 3D, Adrian found a clever way to calculate all of them. Again, and the way you can automate it is the so-called Wyckoff position. So Wyckoff position is just this general notion of a high symmetry point. So it's some set of points in space which are left invariant under a reflection or a rotation or something. So that gives you an automated way to compute all these. Okay, so I was also lucky that Adrian was paying very close attention during Leon's talk. So Leon talked about this spin ice compound, this Presidium compound. And this actually provides an interesting three-dimensional example. So what he was telling us was we had this spin ice compound, and he wanted to ask if you had the electric monopoles, was there a natural way for the electric monopoles to condense? And what he found was when you look at the natural band structure for these monopoles, they always had these degenerate minima which were forced on you, which meant that any simple condensate would actually break the symmetries. So we can ask how this constraint applies here. So this compound is in space group 227. And if you looked at all the existing Liebschultz-Matisse constraints and counted the number of spins, you'd decide that they were trivial according to those constraints. So they would have told you this could have just been a boring insulator or a short-range entangled phase. But when we look at the table, we see that for this space group, the different types of lattices have this Z2 to the 4 classification. And if you look at the locations of the Presidiums, the spin ice compound is actually a non-trivial element here. So that tells you that if you had spin 1/2 moments here, it can't actually be in a short-range entangled phase. So presumably, I don't understand the exact details yet. It having a non-trivial index here must be very closely related to the fact that there's always multiple minima in the band structure here. Though I should say there's a caveat. The result will prove, as I said, requires SO3 symmetry, whereas this material is spin orbit coupled. So eventually we'd like to have a generalization which only relies on time reversal. But I expect the conjecture is the same. Okay, so for the remainder of the talk, I want to briefly explain how I'd prove this. So the logical structure, so what we're able to do is we can prove, to at least to my physics standards, for all the two-dimensional lattices. So the logical structure proceeds in two steps. The first step, we're able to, based on physical arguments, show that a short-range entangled phase is impossible if any of these three conditions is satisfied. So the first of them is the Liebschultz-Matisse one, which is you count whether there's half-integer spin in this reduced unit cell. If there is, then it can't be short-range entangled. The next one was actually discussed in an earlier paper, which said that if there's half-integer spin per unit length of a mirror plane or mirror line, then there's a no-go. The one I'm going to talk about here is quite simple. It says, if there's a half-integer spin on any site with C2 symmetry, then it can't be short-range entangled. So then the second step of the proof, which I won't really discuss, is just showing that these three is logically equivalent to the way I stated the conjecture. Okay, so let me briefly present the argument here because I think it's interesting. Okay, so what I want to prove is if you have a magnet with a spin 1/2 on a site with C2 symmetry, it can't be short-range entangled. So the purposes here, I don't need to consider the full SO3. I can actually just consider the group of pi rotations, which I'll label by X, Y, and Z. So that's a Z2 cross Z2 group sitting inside here. Now, as a group, all of these commute. But because I'm dealing with spin 1/2, the actual quantum mechanical implementation is that they anti-commute. That's what makes it projective. So the trick I'm going to use is I'm going to consider the system of spins on a torus. So somewhere out here it's identified. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to modify the Hamiltonian so as to introduce spin flux. So what I mean by spin flux is there's going to be a set of lines here where I modify the Hamiltonian on this link to flip the sign of y and z while leaving behind x. So this is kind of a general, with U1 we're very familiar with threading flux. This is just the discrete version of it. Now this line eventually terminates at two points, which I require related by the C2 symmetry. So here it's a C2 symmetry about that site. Now I should mention where you put this line is kind of arbitrary. I could have chose any sort of path. There's nothing very physical about where you decide to twist the links. That can be changed by a unitary transformation. but there's really something physical happening here where the line ends. So what I want to do is make use of what symmetries I still have in the problem. So the first one I want is the C2 rotation. So if I take this Hamiltonian and rotate it, or you can't quite see, but the most naive rotation where you just permute the sites, you won't literally get the same Hamiltonian back. And that's because I had this line here where the links were modified and it moves up to the top here. But there's a simple way to fix that. There's a region which should be highlighted here where if I apply what I can think of as a gauge transformation, which is just the symmetry X on the sites in this region, it will move this line back and I'll end up with the same Hamiltonian. So I'm going to find sort of a modified symmetry, which I'll call C2X, which is the combination of the physical rotation combined with the gauge transformation, and that commutes with the Hamiltonian. The second symmetry I'm going to use is just applying the Z operation everywhere. That's the internal one. But I have to remember that on the sites, they actually anti-commute. So now what I want to do is compute what's the commutation relation between this rotation and this internal symmetry. So the key thing is because this has x's in its definition, when I go to compute the commutation relation, I'm going to pick up a negative 1 for every site where I had to apply the gauge transformation. Now, because by assumption there's one site, which is at the origin of the C2, I'm guaranteed that there's an odd number of sites here. So no matter what, I'm going to get a negative sign. So it means I found two symmetries of the Hamiltonian which actually anti-commute, so I'm guaranteed that there's going to be a ground state degeneracy. Okay, so what's interesting about this ground state degeneracy? A degeneracy itself does not necessarily contradict it being short-range entangled. So we actually know that there's a class of these SPT phases called decorated domain walls, where when you thread fluxes into the system, it exactly binds degeneracies. So getting degeneracy itself is not a contradiction. But what I want to argue is that there's something special about this degeneracy which can never be realized in a short-range entangled phase. And the principle I'm going to refer to is something I'll call, degeneracy localization. So the idea is if this was a short-range entangled phase and I get, say, degenerate ground states, there should be a sense in which I can think of those degeneracies as being either on this flux or that flux. So formally, the ways I'd phrase that is if you have D-fold ground states, you should be able to label them by two numbers, A1 and A2, where A1 is the set of degeneracies here and A2 is the set of degeneracies there. And the sense in which they're local is if you look at the reduced density matrix for these sites, the first thing you'll see is if you look at the reduced density matrix for the regions A1 and A2, it should be a tensor product, where in row 1 it only depends on the 1 index, 2 it only depends on the 2 index, up to some small corrections. And if you look at the density matrix in the complement of the fluxes, it shouldn't depend on which degenerate ground state at all. So that's a way of formalizing what it means for the degeneracy to be localized on the flux. That's very different compared to if you have a system with non-abelian anions. There, the entire point is you can't say where the degeneracy is. It's somehow shared between the anions. So this is just an assumption. I think most people would agree that in a short-range entangled phase, degeneracies should take this form. And then the claim, just to finish, is that you can never actually have this commutation relation on local, some localized ground states. So the argument's pretty simple. What I want to do is first say, what's the most general symmetry implementation of the symmetry you can have? So the first thing I learned from C2 is that the degeneracy, the degree of the degeneracy on flux 1 and 2 should be the same, so the dimensions are the same. And then I know because of this locality condition that if I ask how is a local operator like Z, because Z was a product of local operators, implemented in the ground state manifold, it has to be a tensor product of an operator which acts only on the 1 indices and an operator which acts only on the 2 indices. So that falls from locality. And then you can also show that C2, just by an appropriate change of basis on the indices of 2, you can always, without loss of generality, consider it to be the form of a swap, just the swap of the 2 indices. So now we immediately arrive at a contradiction. Let's just compute the commutation relation between Z and C2, assuming this form. So conjugation by C acts as a swap, so it takes Z1, Z2 to Z2, Z1. We want to know, could this ever actually be an anti-commutation relation? The answer is no. So the first thing you learn by trying to solve this equation is that z1 has to be proportional to z2. But then if you just insert that ansatz in, you'll arrive at 1 equals negative 1, which is impossible. So there's something about this algebra where the degeneracy can't be realized locally. So the actual interpretation is, in a magnet like this, the degeneracy is going to be carried by some topological degrees of freedom. Okay. So just to summarize, that proved this physical no-go here, and as hopefully you'll see in the paper later, that's actually enough to prove this conjecture in 2 dimensions. 3 dimensions, we can't prove it yet, so we can do a bunch of funny tricks where now, rather than working with fluxes, you're working with flux tubes, and you put these flux tubes in generalizations of toruses, which are these Bieber-Bach manifolds, and we get a bunch of constraints beyond Liebschultz-Mannes, but there's some cases we haven't dealt with yet, so there's some tool that we're missing in order to prove it in 3 dimensions. And with that, I think my time is up, so I'll skip this part, and thank you.
So you said that on honeycomb lattice spin 1/2, there is a short-range entangled state, is that right?
Yeah.
So can you give us an intuitive picture of that state, how that state is constructed?
I don't have any picture in terms of, say, like some field theoretic degrees of freedom.
No, so for example, yeah. I mean, one thing I can imagine is that you split 1 spin 1/2 into 3 spin 1/2.
Yeah, like so it ends, oh yeah.
So
I don't know quite how to think of it in that language, but it's something like, yeah, it's sort of like on the bonds, you introduce 4 spin 1/2 ancillas. So it's more like on each site, there's 6 spin 1/2s.
But how does it fuse into 1 spin 1/2?
Yeah, so you need to find some channel for fusing all those spin 1/2s into a spin 1/2. Oh, no, it's not 6.
No, it cannot be 6.
It's a direct sum of 2 spin 1/2s rather than the tensor product of 2 spin 1/2s. So it's like spin 1/2 plus spin 1/2. Or you can think of it as it's a spin 1/2 tensor degree of freedom which doesn't transform under spin.
Ah, uh-huh.
Right, so now you put 3 of those on a site.
Yeah.
And that's 3 spin 1/2s is allowed to fuse into a spin 1/2.
Okay, yeah, so that's pretty much what I was guessing. The same picture should also work for the spin 1 on Kagome lattice, is that right? You can pretty much do the same thing, split 1 spin 1 into like 2 spin 1, just like a high school lattice,
yeah,
or something like that.
Basically, I mean, that's just a general picture. You could think of that as a general picture for getting a, you can think of a tensor network as just being a general way to generalize the AKLT construction
where
you're introducing ancilla and then projecting them in some more complicated way than the usual AKLT construction.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So I think one way to interpret this conjecture is basically that there can be a short-range entangled phase only if there's a kind of obvious symmetric valence bond state you can write down.
So do you understand how this intercommutation between Z and C2 is resolved in the topological order state?
That's a good question. I actually haven't thought through it yet.
Okay.
I mean, yeah, I think we sort of understand it, say, in the case of translation, where... So it's a little bit like you need a square root 2 quantum dimension for the defect.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I can say it right away.
So just following up on that, then it must be anyon permuting symmetry, is that?
Would it require that?
Yeah.
I think it'll be more like if you enrich the anions with defects, then in like the combination of defect anion theory, stuff is permuted.
Okay. And second question, okay, maybe this is crazy, but sometimes on surfaces of topological insulators, you can have a constraint that there is actually no gap symmetric state, like there is no topological order allowed. Is it possible with Lipschultz-Mattes?
Yeah, so that was the everything I skipped was, I think that's what you're asking. Like, can you interpret these Liebschultz Manis as being the constraint at the surface of a topological insulator? Oh, I see. So is it possible that when the index is non-zero, like non-trivial, there's not even a gapped order which will? At least in the case where we're considering a lattice of projective representations, there's always a Zn gauge theory you can write down. So at least in that case, the answer is no. There's always just gap Zn gauge theory is a way to solve a magnet of projective representations.
So my question is about the part you skipped. So you reset the three cases, and you explained the third part, and the second part was this half-integer spin per unit length of mirror line. And I didn't really follow your paper, but after attending the morning session, I wonder this second statement may follow naturally if you apply Mike Hamer's dimensional reduction.
Right, yes. Yeah, so I think the other slide.
Did you do the same way? Or?
Yeah, so I think the other slide I skipped is that maybe we can think of my talk as being the boundary of Mike's talk this morning. At least for reflection, sort of the picture is you can think of we're studying this, a lattice of spin 1/2, so you can think of as being the surface of a system of stacked AKLT chains, which each have a dangling spin 1/2. So at least if we only have, reflection, then I think it's just the corresponding case of Mike's talk. So in some ways, you could think of this as an independent check of sort of the developing theory of crystalline SPTs in one higher dimension, but not yet making reference to cohomology classes or anything. But it should be able to serve as a check of it.
Thank you.
More questions? You might have said it, I missed it. So was time reversal included or not included?
Not in what I can quasi-rigorously prove. I've actually used SO3.
Just SO3 and space group.
And the space group. Yeah, so hopefully someone will figure out a better way to prove it where you use the space group and just Kramer's nature, so time reversal. But I don't know how to concretely do that yet.
Any other question? Well, if not, let's thank Mike again. So next speaker is Donna Schenk, and the title of her talk is Identifying and Characterizing Topological States by Entanglement Information Using the MRG.